All right. Hello, everybody. How's it going? Welcome to What I Read Today, which is a podcast about various literature that I read, and then we walk through it together. It's going to be a very fun book club sort of vibe here. So I have not read any of these works before. I have a very minor background in reading some other types of literature. I'm not like, I don't have any sort of degrees or anything like that. So it's more just like a fun discussion between regular people. We're all regular people here, right? All right, cool. So we're going to be starting off with War and Peace today, and for the next quite a few episodes. So this podcast episode is going to be covering the first part of the first book of War and Peace, which is roughly like 110, 120 pages, depending on which translation you have. I have the Maud translation. It's the one by, or my book is from the Oxford Publishing Press, right? So whichever one that one is for you, it seems to work out for me. It's supposed to be a pretty highly regarded translation. So just a little background on this book first before we dive in. Obviously, it is about Napoleon's conquest and invasion into Russia. Of course, this is right after the French Revolution. Napoleon basically takes power, starts a bunch of wars, and does very, very well for quite a time before he does eventually, he is defeated, right? So it's going to be discussing War and Peace and Peace and War and all that fun stuff. The only other Tolstoy works that I've read is A Kingdom of God Within You, or The Kingdom of God is Within You, and A Confession, both of which are pretty short. A Confession is like 80 pages. The Kingdom of God is like 150 or something. And they're nonfiction pieces, just about him and what he believes and stuff like that. So I have a little bit of background in Tolstoy, but nothing crazy. So I'll interject here and there whenever I find things interesting. But let's get started. So I would recommend that you read the first part before you're listening to this. I am going to do my best to summarize as much as I can, but the book is quite detailed. There's a lots of little events that might be important later. And again, because I am reading this for the first time as well, I don't know what's going to be important later and what's not. With so many characters, especially for this book, maybe not the best book to start off with for a new podcast, right? But, you know, one that I'm interested in. Because there are so many characters, it's going to be hard for me to determine who's going to be important and who's not, and what all the meaning is and stuff like that. So read it. And if you don't, I'll do my best to help you along for the ride. So here we are, book one, chapter one. So we are in Petersburg. We open the scene on two aristocrats, Anna Pavlovna, she's described as a favorite of the Dowager Empress, which is basically the Tsar right now is Alexander I. His mother is a widow, and she is the Dowager Empress. And Prince Vasily, who is basically this hateful father guy, aristocrat, who wishes to marry off his children for monetary gain. He loves money, right? Over morals, even. And as they discuss, they basically just discuss Napoleon Bonaparte's recent activities, which would be, the conquest of Lucca and Genoa, as well as the murder of this Duke guy, who basically is just a Frenchman that is killed and not really that important, but all the nations that dislike Napoleon kind of stir it up to be something more than it is, as far as I'm aware. So they rant about a famous Prussian neutrality, which did not age well, certainly, into the modern era, but at the time, Prussia was remaining neutral after being famously defeated quite easily by Napoleon, and England's commercial culture getting in the way of the war effort, despite England at this time being the only nation at war with France. Everybody else is at peace for the time. Of course, the Napoleonic Wars took place over a long period of time relative to any of our modern wars. And so nations were at peace and at war with Napoleon on and off. Lots of coalitions. I believe there were five or six. I don't exactly remember. But if there's one takeaway here, it is that the Russian nobles frequently speak French. So this is both historically rooted in Catherine the Great's Francophilia. And she was they call her an enlightened despot. You know, she was basically just like an authoritarian ruler, but she enacted some good changes here and there because, you know, some people aren't all bad. This is also representative of the Russian aristocracy's moral decline. So the Russian aristocracy at this time, and Tolstoy is criticized for this in War and Peace, they didn't speak French as often as they do in this book, right? In this book, they speak French all the time, and it's interjected here and there, like every other word, not even like complete sentences in Russian or English or French, right? So it's kind of just a big mishmash, which didn't really happen and isn't representative, but it's more the symbolism of the thing, and that, you know, the people who speak French typically are going to be our morally degenerate characters, if you're okay with me using that word. And also them being out of touch with the Russian-speaking Russian people, right? It's kind of weird, right, to have this ruling class of Russians that speak French. Like, I've heard later, I read some bits about War and Peace, that the Russian aristocracy have to get Russian tutors because they don't even know how to speak Russian enough to order around their servants and stuff like that. Crazy stuff. So a personal question that I have, a takeaway from this chapter, is whether Tolstoy meant this as a personal indictment against only the Russian aristocracy, or whether it was against the Russian aristocracy in addition to lambasting French culture, or whether it was just he hated aristocracy in general, right? And this was just the people that he was focusing on for this specific book, which is why they're painting it in, you know, such a bad light. But anyways, on to chapter 2. And again, so these chapters are very, very small, so only a few pages at most, right? I think the last chapter, chapter 25, is like the most, being like 5 pages in my book. So yeah, when I say chapters, it's really more like, it's definitely not like the modern conception of chapter. Anyways, War and Peace genre bends, as they say. So, chapter 2, we start with Anna Pavlovna's party beginning. So, Prince Vasily is whisked away by his daughter, while Anna greets the guests and directs them to her aunt. The aunt is like a very old woman, kind of just sits there, greets each guest in the same boring manner. They all say the same thing, while the guest just tries to rush through the interaction as fast as is polite, right? So, they're just, you know, going through the motions. To me, this shows the nobility's insistence on tradition, despite being aware of its stupidity and the vexation that it casts on its practitioners. So a good quote from Karl Marx, love him or hate him, the tradition of the dead weigh like a nightmare upon the living, or that was my bad remembrance of it. And it's basically kind of encapsulated in this little moment. Anyways, on from the aunt. We are also introduced to Princess Bolkonskaya, who is apparently the prettiest person alive, and also someone who knows it. So she is seen as being vain, self-important, while also conversely offering everyone around her joy, just by being in her presence, basking in her beauty, I guess. So she is also someone who prides themselves on the approval of others, announcing herself by saying, "You wrote that it was going to be quite a small reception. Just see how badly I am dressed." This, of course, while she is wearing a, quote, lace-trimmed dainty gray dress. However, she does express something poignant and central to the novel, that of the skepticism regarding war, saying, "My husband is deserting me. He is going to get himself killed. Tell me what this wretched war is for." This is something that Tolstoy would embrace later in his life, basically a very, very anti-war stance rooted in Christian biblical text, specifically. He really only talks about the Gospels. he doesn't really think much of the Old Testament, at least from what I've read. The star of the show, in my heart, though, is, of course, Pierre. So he is the illegitimate son of a dying count and is addressed with little respect by Anna Pavlovna. However, she also fears him, not for his great stature, which, of course, he is very tall, but for his clever, shy, but natural countenance. So essentially, he's kind of just like a regular guy who's thrust into this kind of society. So this puts him in stark contrast to these aristocrats who moments earlier were engaging in torturous mannerisms with Anna's aunt. So again, very good contrast there. Pierre, of course, did not even deign to grant the aunt, of which he knew nothing or cared about. He didn't even speak to her, right? He just passed her by because he didn't know her and he didn't really care about her. So it's kind of what a normal person would do, right? Instead of going out of your way to greet this one person just because everybody else is doing it. And most importantly, though, or maybe the reason for this behavior, is that Pierre was educated abroad and had come back to Petersburg to converse with the educated elite. This means that, actually kind of like the Russian aristocracy, he's not really entirely Russian, but is certainly distant from the mannerisms of the Francophile Russian elite. Notably, he doesn't speak French through the whole chapter. And I don't remember if he ever speaks French. We'll see. Chapter 3. This chapter continues the party and makes note of Anna Pavlovna's ability to shape the atmosphere to her will, reviving conversation when it was becoming stale and calming groups who had become overly noisy. In addition to Princess Bolkonskaya, Princess Helen is also described as radiant and beautiful, with a similar ability to make people happy. So is this Tolstoy equating beauty with happiness, or is this just resting on the surface level understanding that the aristocracy have of their environment? So more so saying like, oh, because the aristocracy are only, you know, concerned with superficial matters, of course someone's physical appearance is going to bring them joy, because they don't understand, you know, kind of what's laying beneath the surface, who the person actually is. They don't care about anything except, you know, the motions and the mannerisms of high society. So, Prince Ippolit is also introduced to the narrative as a man that is so confident in speaking that, quote, he is either very witty or very stupid, unquote. So, you know, I feel great brotherhood with this man. I do believe that the narrative leans towards the latter, aka he is very stupid. More importantly, though, Prince Andrei, Princess Bolkonskaya's husband, he is much like Pierre in that he's out of place of high society, but more because of a general disgust of the aristocrats around him, including his own wife. So him and Pierre instantly bond because they both recognize, oh, this guy isn't quite like the others. But where Pierre is more kind of innocent and offends the high society unknowingly, just through his good nature and refusal to engage with certain mannerisms, Prince Andrei was raised in this society, but he just hates it so much, which is going to be important later. So chapter 4, as Prince Vasily leaves the party with his daughter Helen, an elderly lady stops him and requests for an appointment of her son to the guard. So for this, Vasily would have to ask the emperor himself. After debating for a moment, he feels something like qualms of conscience and acquiesces, if only because the lady's father had given him a head start in his career. So I believe that this scene represents the rule of law that the rich Russians abide by, and also how it contrasts with Napoleon's actions in Chapter 1. So in Chapter 1, Anna Pavlovna and Prince Vasily discuss how Napoleon has killed the Duke de Enghien. I don't like French, so I'm not going to even bother. A man who the Russians thought was kind to Napoleon and even observed him fainting without raising a fuss, you know, unlike a bad friend would be like, oh, look, Napoleon has fainted. He's so weak. So a man does a bad turn to a kind man in French society, whereas here it is shown how society is supposed to behave, maybe, or how Russian nobility behaves, even though they are Francophilic. An eye for an eye, but also a gift for a gift. All that to say, Prince Vasily helps this old lady. Back at the gathering, the group that Anna has formed discussed Napoleon's seizure of Genoa and Lucca, as well as his coronation. They claim that he will destroy good French society, which might be showing their priorities, as well as saying that the, quote, sovereigns will soon turn against him. I'm not sure what the sovereigns mean. I don't know if this is like French aristocracy or other countries other than England declaring war. Again, I'm not entirely sure. It's just a kind of more like a throwaway line. Andrei begins to disagree with them and plays a sort of a devil's advocate to the group by quoting Napoleon and saying that the French people support Napoleon. Pierre wholeheartedly agrees with Andrei and begins glorifying Napoleon by saying that the murder of the Duke was a necessary part of progress and that, quote, the revolution cannot stop for one man's life. Of course, the group is horrified, most of all Anna. Although I have to say, I didn't write this in my notes, but I have to say that really Pierre is, you know, not the glorification of Napoleon, but I think he's basically just saying the group is above one man's life, right? Which really isn't that crazy of a thing to say. And I feel like most people nowadays, and probably back then as well, kind of agreed with the notion, right? The group is greater than the whole. Or no, the whole is greater than one man, right? Anyways, but even more than that. So Pierre also says, quote, no, Napoleon is great because he rose superior to the revolution, suppressed its abuses, preserved all that was good in it, equality of citizenship and freedom of speech and of the press, and only for that reason did he obtain power. By Pierre's reckoning, Napoleon sounds more progressive than even America. So whereas Andrei is, again, like this devil's advocate character, Pierre is very much more like the gung-ho, I actually believe this stuff, and you know, even though I'm not in France and I don't experience any of that, I'm a wholehearted Napoleon guy, straight to my core. And the book constantly shows, like, his youth and that, you know, he's just young and innocent. And despite him saying this, people still like him. So we'll get to that. So despite these words that horrified the group, they couldn't help but feel comforted by him whenever he smiled. Basically, when he was showing them that he was authentic and not stiff and controlled like the rest of nobility. So he's not getting anything out of saying Napoleon's a good guy. Telling that to Russians, it's stupid and crazy. It kind of just shows that, you know, he is noble and is telling the truth. Kind of like if you read The Idiot by Dostoevsky, he is very much a Prince Mishkin character up to this point, or at least I think so. So again, special emphasis is also put on his youth whenever he is mentioned. A character at one point calls him a young Jacobin. Again, showing that aristocracy's preference for French society by saying a young Jacobin instead of any other kind of like radical Russian group. While Pierre betrays his country by glorifying Napoleon, they betray their country by being more French than Russian. At least Pierre's misstep comes from his genuine want of a better world, because he believes in the revolution, right? Whereas these aristocrats, right, if the revolution was benefiting them, they'd be gung-ho, even if it hurt the Russian peasants. But Pierre, at least, is trying to pay lip service to, you know, elevating the peasantry, despite him, of course, being in the aristocracy. Ibelitte's stupidity is also assured when he tells a very poor joke and is praised for it because he so kindly made Pierre's outrageous statements less awkward. All praise Ibelitte. Chapter 5, the party is dispersing, and Tolstoy pays special attention to Pierre's inability to leave the room gracefully. He took someone else's hat instead of his own, and he was also unable to say something particularly agreeable before he left. However, quote, he did not reply and only bowed, but again, everybody saw a smile, which said nothing, unless, perhaps, opinions are opinions, but what you say, what a capital good-natured fellow I am. And everybody, including Anna Pavlovna, felt this. We also get a little scene with the horrible Prince Ibelitte attempting to hit on Princess Bolkonskaya, Andrei's wife. He and another partygoer discuss basically how Ibelitte would be a much better match, and they pity Andrei, even though Andrei really doesn't care for his wife and doesn't really seem all too concerned with this interaction. Pierre and Andrei discuss Pierre's job situation, namely he doesn't have one, having returned from his education at the age of 20, with a mission from his father to find some means of employment. Pierre says that he would join the army and fight in the war, except that he doesn't want to help Austria and England defeat a great man. Andrei laughs and replies that he doesn't know why he's joining the army, except that his present lifestyle doesn't suit him. So Andrei is just trying to get away from this Russian society, which he hates, and is really not even Russian, right? As is constantly suggested by all of this French talk. So chapter 6. Still in Andrei's room, the princess bursts in, complains to Andrei that she would rather he not go to war, and also makes some broad generalizations like, quote, women don't have the need for war, and, quote, all men are egotists. Andrei is rude to her, and at the end, kisses her hand as she departs as if she were a stranger. Andrei discloses to Pierre that he is incredibly dissatisfied with marriage and wishes for the whole world that he had never married that princess. In my opinion, this reveals his true reason for going off to war. It would be as if he wasn't married at all. Andrei also makes some very broad generalizations of women, so maybe he and the princess are fit for each other. Pierre is shocked, understandable, given that he thinks very highly of his friend, and this is tantamount to revealing your deepest, darkest secret of which you are most ashamed. They discuss some more, and Pierre promises Andrei that he won't go to his friend Kurigin's. However, on the way home, he decides to break his promise, rationalizing it by saying that since he could die tomorrow, what does honor or dishonor amount to? And besides, he had already promised Anatole, which is Anatole Kurigin, the man that is trying to be married off to Prince Andrei's sister, that he would go. So Pierre walks in to Kurigin's house on a most jolly scene. All the men at the party are drunk, and one of them, named Dolokhov, had taken up a bet that he could drink a whole bottle of rum sitting on a windowsill without grabbing onto anything and not fall off. While this man is purported to have a very high alcohol tolerance, potentially implying that he is an alcoholic, it is still a dangerous feat as a man who fell would surely die. If he did it, an Englishman at the party would have to give him 100 imperial marks. Despite the fear and horror that the drunks felt at the prospect, Dolokhov managed it. Pierre, already drunk, and whether to share in the glory or for some other reason, said he would do it as well, but no one took him seriously as he was a very wobbly drunk, prone to tripping on the stairs. The scene closes with Pierre dancing with a bear cub that the drunks had been entertaining themselves with. What this could symbolize is a mystery to me. Of course, the most obvious symbolism is that the bear is Russia, but what Pierre dancing with Russia means is again unknown to me. Perhaps it is just a bear. Also, I had a thought, just sitting here. Pierre's main motivation, or why he's back in Petersburg, is to reintegrate into Russian society. So maybe it's more of like a symbolism of, you know, Pierre's dancing with Russia, dipping his toe into the cultural waters of the Russian aristocracy, or something like that. Or, of course, there's no symbolism at all. So chapter 7, centering the story on Moscow now, moving on from Petersburg, the Rostovs are receiving guests who are congratulating them, both the mother and the daughter. Apparently in Russia at this time, anybody who is named after a saint In this case, Saint Natalie was congratulated as if it was their birthday. It is mentioned to the two Natalies about Pierre, Anatole, and Dolokhov's antics and the kind of trouble that they got in. Apparently, this is also enough to send Pierre's father, the Count, into an illness when he found out, even though he was already sick at the beginning of the book. Dolokhov was degraded a rank in the army, previously being an infantry officer at the time of the bet. Pierre's father sent him to Moscow, and Anatole's father covered up whatever he had done, although he was also ordered out of Petersburg. Apparently, these three youngins had brought a bear with them in a carriage, maybe the same bear that Pierre was dancing with, so maybe the bear was just set up and not symbolism. And when they were apprehended by the police, they tied the bear to the policeman's back and threw them in the river. Maybe that bear that I mentioned beforehand, again, was just set up and didn't symbolize anything at all then. Anyhow, the visitors also mentioned to the Rostovs that Pierre is regarded as rich because he is likely to inherit the dying count's estate, his father, despite him being illegitimate and quite young compared to his other sons. It was also rumored that Prince Vasily is traveling to Moscow to see the count and also convince him to give Prince Vasily the estate, given that he is his eldest son-in-law. So chapter 8. In this short chapter, we are introduced to the Rostovs properly. There are Count Ilya Andreevich Rostov and Countess Natalia Rostova, the head of the family, along with their four children. The oldest and most adult-like is Vera Ilyinichna, her 13-year-old sister, Natalie Ilyinicha, 20-year-old Nikolai Ilyich, a socially awkward young man whose friend Boris, who is described as his opposite, handsome and self-assured, is also there, and the 9-year-old Pyotr Ilyich. It is revealed that Boris is becoming an officer in the army, so Nikolai is entering the service as well, quote, for friendship's sake, although he states that it is just because he believes that is his rightful vocation. Again, showing how Boris is basically a better version of Nikolai, and that Nikolai is very much dependent upon him. Nikolai also flirts with Sonia, his 15-year-old adopted cousin, for quite some time. The feeling is mutual, for better or worse, but the problem is that Nikolai also flirts with Julie Karagina, one of the visitors and a relation of Anatole, showing how he is immature and just throws his affection at anyone that notices him. This hurts Sonia dearly, and Nikolai rushes out of the room to find her after he notices that she has left the room in agitation. Tolstoy pontificates on childhood. Although Nikolai is 20, he is really shown as acting like a very young boy, through Anna Mikhailovna, another visitor, saying, quote, how plainly these young people wear their hearts on their sleeves. The Countess responds, yes, and how much suffering, how much anxiety one has to go through, that we might rejoice in them now. And yet really, the anxiety is better now than the joy. One is always, always anxious, especially at this age, so dangerous both for girls and boys. The Countess also mentions how Natalie, her young daughter, is in love with Boris. So, chapter 10. In this chapter, Nikolai and Sonia make up by kissing, mostly to show how fleeting young feelings are, in my opinion. And Natasha and Boris also profess their love for each other, although Boris opts not to kiss Natasha again until he can ask for her hand in 4 years. Again, I believe this is to show how he is better than Nikolai, although I imagine things will rarely keep being so black and white throughout the book, but I'm not sure. So chapter 11, we are shown that nobody likes Vera, the oldest sibling, and she in turn likes no one. Kind of chicken and egg problem that isn't resolved, though having read Tolstoy, I imagine he would say that it is a learned behavior due to how she was treated initially. So it starts with her mother forcibly dismissing her from the room because she wants to be alone with Anna Mikhailovna. Vera then leaves and bothers Natasha, Nikolai, Sonia, and Boris for their affection for each other. Then, being satisfied with her work, she leaves. So she barges into the room that all the young children are, or, you know, young people are in, you know, talking, chatting with each other. She makes a mess of things, insults people, and then when they insult her, she's just like, this isn't fair, and she leaves. So the rest of the chapter is filled with the Countess and Anna Mikhailovna discussing finances. The Countess is quite poor because their family is living a lifestyle they cannot afford, and she throws out how Nikolai would only be a cadet in the army, which is an unpaid officer position, due to him not being able to get a commission. Anna reveals to the reader that she was the elderly lady that pestered Prince Vasily to talk to the Emperor about Boris getting a commission into the officer corps. During this, they also discuss whether Boris, being the godson of the sickly Count of Bezukhov, which is Pierre's father, will inherit anything of his grand estate when he dies. Chapter 12. Count Bezukhov is really kind of the heart of this first part. It's like everybody's waiting for him to die, and whatever happens is going to influence like the rest of this little clique, right? So chapter 12. Having left the party, the Mikhailovs travel to Count Bezukhov, hoping to have a meeting so that Boris could inherit his estate, or at least part of it. As they enter the house, they meet Prince Vasily, who shows great haughtiness towards Anna, because she is, again, also very poor, but nonetheless allows them to wait for a meeting with the Count. Boris heads off to find Pierre, who is living there after his expulsion from Petersburg. Chapter 13, background is given regarding Pierre. Apparently, he is barred from seeing his father, the Count, and everybody in the household is very displeased toward him and, quote, treat him as if he was a leper. When Boris finds him in his room pretending to be Napoleon, Pierre doesn't recognize Boris, having last seen him 6 years ago. Boris proceeds by explaining that his family, though he really only speaks for himself, doesn't want any part of the Count's inheritance due to them being very poor, while the Count is very rich. They get along well instantly, and Boris is shown as being a more intelligent, level-headed Pierre. Both speak plainly and are humble, but while one has strong opinions on everything he reads about, the other concerns himself only with things that he can change. For example, Pierre begins to speak on Napoleon's plan to invade England and its pros and cons. This plan is, of course, ill-fated, and both the French and Spanish navy will be destroyed by the English at the Battle of Trafalgar. Boris leaves, but not before inviting Pierre to dinner with the Rostovs, which Pierre accepts, wanting to be in Boris's company more. I should also mention, when Pierre mentions or talks about Napoleon's plan to invade England, Boris is basically like, you know, this is a war, Liz. I don't want to talk about this. I don't know anything about it. I don't read anything in the paper aside from what affects me personally. But then later, when the conversation gets a little bit awkward, they both decide to return to talking about Napoleon, which is a little bit funny. So chapter 14. This chapter is quite a humanizing one for the Rostovs. So despite their being on the brink of poverty, the Countess scrounges up 700 rubles, which I don't know exactly how well that equates to like our money today, but it sounds like it's quite a bit of money for back then, and gives it to Anna when she returns from the Count's because she is so stricken by her friends being in an even worse position financially than her. So, you know, even though they are kind of like, you know, they are aristocracy, despite being like slightly poor because they live above their means, it is a little humanizing. So it's not completely all the aristocracy are bad and speak French and, you know, whatever. So chapter 15, we open on the Count listening to a conversation between an old civilian man known for his sharp tongue, named Shinshin, and Lieutenant Berg, Vera's lover. Vera being the annoying oldest sister in the Rostov family. So Berg speaks about himself, but much like Pierre, due to his youthful honesty, he wins over his listeners. Berg is also the man that Boris will travel with when joining his regiment in the army. This conversation is pretty funny and interesting, but I could not decipher the meaning, so I encourage you, if you did end up reading it, just, you know, let me know. So Maria Dmitrievna is introduced as a harsh but truthful woman who used to advise the ill Count and only speaks in Russian, which I imagine is a point for her in Tolstoy's eyes. She scolds Pierre for his foolishness at Petersburg. Importantly, Nikolai attends a dinner with Julie Kerrigan and not Sonia, much to the latter's angst. So again, this Nikolai guy, who really is kind of the inferior youngster of the group between him and Boris. He has two people that are interested in him, and he keeps spurning both of them, so it's a little bit funny, but kind of sad too. So chapter 16, a German-born colonel in the Russian army was discussing the declaration of war. Notably, despite being a German, he speaks no French, or he might speak French, but he doesn't say anything in French, and he's also the most patriotic one of anyone at dinner. He's very, very pro-Russia, which is, again, super funny, and the way Tolstoy, or I guess my translation, writes him speaking, it's like you're reading a German accent. It's pretty funny. Nikolai is just about the only other attendee that agrees with him. Our honest woman, Dmitrievna, has something to say as well. Quote, it's all in God's hands. You may die in your bed, or God may spare you in a battle. Which, again, I kind of feel like is Tolstoy trying to speak to the reader about his own opinion. But, again, I don't have anything to confirm that. So chapter 17, Natasha leaves after dinner and to find Sonia, who is sobbing, both due to Nikolai's rudeness, is going away to the army, and because it is difficult as second cousins to get married, so Natasha consoles her and they both go off to sing. Natasha also tries to attract Pierre, both for herself, because Pierre is, you know, described as a worldly and grown-up man, after all, and at her mother's request, and they end up dancing together. Poor Boris. So now it's like all the children are just like throwing their love and affection anywhere that they can get it, right? So, or for anyone who will receive it. It's interesting. So chapter 18, the Count Bezukhov has suffered another stroke, and the doctor thinks that he won't make it through the night. So Prince Vasily attempts to get Princess Katerina Semyonovna, one of the Count's daughters and his sister-in-law, to destroy one of the Count's letters that would legitimize Pierre, making him the sole inheritor of the fortune. Little does Vasily know, Catherine, well, at this point, has some integrity, and refuses because she wants no part of the inheritance anyways. She also has a really good bit of dialogue as well. Which again, whether it's Tolstoy speaking for himself or for, you know, some portion of society, I don't know. But anyway, she says, "Yes, I was a fool. I still believed in people, loved them, and sacrificed myself, but only the base, the vile, succeed. I know who has been intriguing." However, the princess is led to believe that the person intriguing has been Anna Mikhailovna, Boris's mother, the poor lady, that she's been intriguing with the Count about the will, and because of her hatred of her, she tells Vasily where the inheritance is. So, I guess hatred over ideals, people. That's the moral of this short chapter. So, chapter 19, I only have one note. Pierre is guided to the Count by Anna Mikhailovna, who is asked to see him. Pierre is slightly frightened and decides to blindly follow Anna, not having the strength to think anything for himself. Chapter 20, at the unction, which is an Orthodox rite that is given to the dying, as far as I understand it, and as far as the book has explained it, it is administered to Count Bezukhov. Pierre sits through the ritual as it occurs in his father's bedroom, essentially dumbfounded. Only at the end does he regain his intelligence and starts breaking down in tears when he sees his father unable to even move his arms. I believe that Tolstoy is imparting that the reality of death upon both the reader and also upon Pierre through this like lengthy rite, and finally at the end, you know, he just breaks down. Chapter 21. As the group that was administering the rite, as well as the audience, including Pierre, Anna Mikhailovna, and the doctor leave the room, Anna observes Princess Katerina attempting to enter the bedchamber and have the Count sign what is most probably a will, but not the one that would give Pierre anything. Anna Mikhailovna physically bars her from entry, and before Prince Vasily, who had left in the middle of the unction, most likely to get the document for the princess, can intervene, the Count is pronounced dead. Prince Vasily instantly becomes truly remorseful. Tolstoy writes, "Ah, my friend," said he, taking Pierre by the elbow, and there was a voice, a sincerity, and weakness Pierre had never observed in it before. "How often we sin, how much we deceive, and all for what? I'm near 60, dear friend, I too. All will end in death, all. Death is awful," and he burst into tears. So yeah, I mean, again, I feel like this is one, you know, A, very humanizing for the aristocracy, and also kind of, again, as Tolstoy speaking through the novel, you know, death is awful. As, you know, the princess said, you know, war is awful in the beginning of the book, right? You know, the aristocracy consciously rejecting these things, and yet they will be going to war either way. So Anna comforts the prince and leads him to a place in the grand house where he can rest and mourn, but he shows no real sadness at the Count's passing, instead, as always, reminding Pierre to look after her son Boris as his father would have wished. So this is a really interesting contrast here, mostly because while Anna is shown as being a more heroic, if pathetic, figure compared to Prince Vasily, she is, in the end, unconcerned with death and feels no remorse for profiting off a dead and dying man, or at least attempting to. Meanwhile, Prince Vasily, generally showed to also be a schemer who wishes to profit off a dying man, feels genuine regret at the end. I wonder, though, if he had gotten that second will signed, whether he would feel more remorse and regret or none at all. Chapter 22. The book now centers on Bald Hills. Nikolai Andreevich Bolkonsky, a retired general-in-chief of the highest military command, Princess Maria and her friend Mademoiselle French, Bourienne. Nikolai is nicknamed the King of Prussia, in reference to Frederick the Great, who is known for being extremely meticulous, exacting, and disciplined. Nikolai is exactly this, highly valuing activity and intelligence, even so much as to educate his daughter himself. This was extremely unusual for the time, and now even, as most of the time tutors were hired to teach children, or else they were sent abroad like Pierre. Nikolai was also exiled to his estate under the previous emperor, Tsar Paul, and refused to return to Moscow once the exile was lifted under the new Tsar, instead living at his estate and, quote, remarking that anyone who wanted to come and see him could come the 100 miles from Moscow to the Bald Hills, while he himself needed no one and nothing. Unquote. If you didn't catch it from that quote, old Nikolai is not, you know, exactly a very nice man, and his daughter fears him, as do his servants and even the men appointed to oversee the county where he lives when they go to visit. In this chapter, he begins to educate his now 20-year-old daughter in geometry, which she doesn't understand, due to being so afraid of her own father. After she leaves and goes to her room, she opens a letter from her childhood best friend, who she misses so dearly, Julie Kerrigan, the same one that visited the Rostovs and, is attracted to Nikolai. Not this Nikolai, but, Nikolai Rostov. Julie reveals that, she dearly loved Nikolai Rostov and is very depressed because he is going off to war, and that Pierre has become the new Count of Bezukhov after inheriting the fortune after all, and that Princess Maria is being considered as a match for Anatole, Pierre's mischievous friend from Petersburg. Princess Maria writes back, reproaching Julie for her youthful love, saying that Christian love of one's neighbor and enemy are more worthy than some fascination with a young man. I imagine that, due to her longing to be with Julie as a friend or otherwise, she might be a tad jealous here and letting it show. She writes back about the inheritance. Quote, "If I pity Prince Vasily, but am still more sorry for Pierre. So young and burdened with such riches, to what temptations will he be exposed? If I were asked what I desired most on earth, it would be to be poorer than the poorest beggar." I think that this highlights both Tolstoy's personal views on wealth, but also on the hypocrisy of rich Christians. Maria is free to run from home and really become the poorest beggar on earth, but she would rather stay at her father's grand estate, writing letters to her best friend. Chapter 23. Prince Andrei and his wife, who was revealed to be Princess Maria's brother in the last chapter, arrives, and there is a big scene between the two princesses with a lot of crying and kissing, even though they had only met once before. Andrei apparently loves and respects his father instead of fearing him. Whether this is because he no longer lives on the estate, or his childhood was so long ago, or for some other reason, I am not sure. Maybe he always loved him. I should mention that, Princess Maria also respects her father even more than Andrei, to the point that she won't criticize him at all, but, deep down she does fear him, right? As opposed to Andrei, who deep down loves his father. So Andrei also does not appear disgusted at his father like he does with everybody else, even his sister and wife. And the only other person that he doesn't appear disgusted with is Pierre. Andrei and his father discuss the war plans, and much like Pierre in his father's bedroom, I think Andre's father is beginning to come to the realization that Andrei might not return from the war, showing this by his apparent disinterest in the war plans when he was so interested just a few minutes ago. But that's just a theory, a game theory, even. So, chapter 24. This is a short chapter, but essentially the whole family ate dinner, talked some more politics, and the old prince had a good remark about how the Germans couldn't be anyone but each other, which didn't age well until the last 100 years. And also, yeah, I'm sure there's something I missed in this chapter, but I didn't really have a lot of notes on it, so there you go. Chapter 25. As Prince Andrei is getting ready to leave his father's estate for war, he is interrupted in his packing and contemplating process by his sister Maria, who bestows on him an icon of Jesus to wear into battle, as his grandfather and father did before him. So, a little context, if you haven't read the book, Maria is, of course, super, super Christian, very trusting in God in a very orthodox way. So, I would like to think that this is a clear-cut expression of Maria's strong faith in God, b, ironic in that it contrasts Maria's faith in God with her faith that this little icon, this physical manifestation of nothing, will save Andrei from death and war. In other words, a more pagan superstition as opposed to like a pure Christian faith. And c, maybe hinting at Andrei becoming a larger believer in God, although it is not exactly clear to the reader thus far whether he is even a believer at all. And it's hard to tell if his scoffing at Maria's antics of faith previously in the book is because he thinks she is silly or whether he thinks God is. The chapter ends with Andrei saying his goodbyes. On the way to see his wife, he accidentally meets up with Maria's friend, Mademoiselle Bourienne, in the hallway for what is apparently the third time, and seeing that she is clearly in love with him, he angrily brushes her off. Before entering his wife's room, he hears her account of phrase and story that he's heard her tell at least 5 times now, which basically shows that she's kind of like a robot. She's very emblematic of the aristocracy we see, the exact type of people that are contrasted with people like Pierre and Andre, the worst of the nobility, even. Maybe the worst of humanity. He then tells his father goodbye. The old prince tries to act disinterested again, but eventually angrily rushes Andrei out of the study before he breaks down in tears, meaning I was spot on a few chapters ago with my guess last time that, of course, he is very sad that his son is going off to war and, even fears his death. Finally, he frigidly wishes his wife farewell, who faints. mostly because, he sees her waiting for him to say goodbye, and he's like, basically, like, go on with your routine, which, causes her much distress. Maria makes the sign of the cross as Prince Andrei leaves the house. And there you go. So I'm really enjoying this book so far. It's super slow going with all the annotating that I am doing to make the episodes. And I'm also reading some other books on the side. But being only 10% of the way through, I can't say I find the book boring at all, which I don't really like reading internet reviews of books because you don't know the person who wrote them, so you don't know if your taste's in line. But I heard a lot like it's really boring and it drags on. It's just people in rooms talking for a lot of the time, which I feel like is a lot of literature. Like I recently read East of Eden and The Idiot, which is basically all people just talking in rooms, and I didn't find those boring at all. I really do enjoy this book. All the characters are interesting. They have motivations. They have witty lines, or they're there for you to laugh at them, like Prince Ippolit. The scenes are meaningful and chock full of symbolism, which I'm sure I'm barely scratching the surface of. And most of all, it can be quite funny. So I do hope you guys do enjoy the first episode. No idea when I'll get finished with the second part here, but, you know, I'm plodding my way through. I was kind of thinking of, you know, recording all of these and then releasing them at once, but given that I don't really have an audience, I don't really see that being necessary. So, yeah, hope you did enjoy. Rate the podcast or whatever if you like, if you found this one interesting. And also follow the podcast wherever you're watching so that you can get the next episode right in your inbox. So, there you go. Hope you do have a good day and adios.